Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's guest is interested in the work that makes all other work possible. She's talking about the millions of domestic workers in the United States who work as nannies, housekeepers, and caregivers. Most of these workers are women, many from other countries. They go into other people's homes every day to make it possible for those people to go out into the world and do what they do. How and why must we bring dignity and respect to that work? We'll find out from Ai Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of Caring Across Generations. Her new book is The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patty. It's great to be here.
I'm going to start with the first page of the second chapter of your book, and this is a quote by Rosalind Carter, which to me says it all. There are only four kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who need caregiving.
That's exactly right. And I always add, we're usually more than one of those identities at any given moment. The experience and relationship to caregiving is so universal for all of us.
In fact, you say this is something that all 314 million Americans need to care about.
Absolutely. Whether we're family caregivers worried about our aging loved ones or have a family member with a disability, or we do caregiving as our paid profession, or we're thinking about planning for the future and know that we have family members who will need care, this really does touch all of us, every age, people of all walks of life. And it's also something that we don't think enough about or talk enough about publicly.
In fact, you refer to this population of caregiver as the most invisible, visible population in the country.
It's true. The paid caregiving workforce is invisible in that they're working in people's private homes, behind closed doors. You never know in any given neighborhood which households are workplaces and which are not. On the other hand, we all have a relationship to caregivers. I have somebody who's caring for my grandmother.
Mrs. Sun.
She's quite dear to our family, and she's an incredibly important part of our family. And I find as I go around the country and meet people that everybody knows very closely and deeply somebody who does caregiving work.
Now, in 2007, you founded the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Why was there a need for such an organization, and how has that need expanded in the past 8 years?
It's one of the greatest ironies, I think, of how our economy and our society works, where the people who care for the most precious elements of our lives, our children, our grandparents, our parents, our homes, are among the most vulnerable and undervalued workers in our economy today. People are working full-time or more than full-time and still unable to make ends meet. And there's really no standards. There's this long history of exclusion from some of the most basic labor protections.
Minimum wage, for example.
Minimum wage, the right to form a union, protection from discrimination and harassment. I mean, really, occupational safety and health protections. So many of the basic protections that most of us don't even think about because we take them for granted actually exclude domestic workers. And so what you have is a situation that I often compare to the Wild West, because you just never quite know what you're going to get. You might find a wonderful family who you stay with for generations, which I hear all the time, those kinds of stories. Or you could find a modern-day slavery, human trafficking situation, which we also hear about, and everything in between. You just never quite know what you're going to get. And it just means that everybody is equally vulnerable.
You say that most of us want to do the right thing.
It's true.
But we don't necessarily know what the right thing means in this situation.
That's right. We've never really treated this work of caring for families as real work. And therefore, we've not accounted for the roles and responsibilities of employers. And we've not formalized it in a way that there's clear expectations on both ends. And most people who hire other people to work in their homes don't think of themselves as employers, right? They think of themselves as needing some extra help. And that's a challenge because it is employment.
And what they don't think of is that this person, while they're caring for your family in some capacity, are they making enough money after a full day's work to adequately care for their own family?
Exactly. Therein lies the core challenge here is how do we have an economy where the people who care for our loved ones can earn enough to care for their own?
Well, how do we do that? You are so optimistic about this situation, and you talk about it in this win-win way that
yes.
not only can we provide the care that we need for our family, but we can care for the caregivers. How do we do both?
I really am optimistic. It's completely authentic because I think that this is the moment to transform how we do this work, how we think about this work, how we value this work. Right now, we're experiencing this tremendous demographic shift in this country where the baby boom generation is starting to reach retirement age at a rate of 10,000 people per day. So in 2015...
Every eight seconds.
In 2015 alone, 4 million of us will turn 65. And then because of advances in healthcare, people are living longer than ever. And so we are about to have the largest older population we've ever had. And the need is just exploding. And so as a result, the home care workforce is the fastest growing occupation in the country. And it's undeniable that people want to age at home, in their communities, connected to their families, and that a home care workforce can really help support that.
AARP says that 90% of us want to die at home, not in a nursing home, not in assisted living.
We care about quality of life, and we know that quality of life is deeply enhanced by being connected to your family in a familiar environment, especially for people with dementia or Alzheimer's. Being in your community, in the place that is familiar to you, is so important to quality of life. And in order for us to create more care choices, we need to strengthen this workforce. And so it's the win-win here is more of us being able to age in place, connected to our families and communities, with the support and the choice to have home care workers supporting that.
The part that I think a lot of people are having a hard time getting their head around is so often the people who need care, they are struggling couples themselves. They're often raising their own children. They only have so much money to provide the care, let's say, for an elder parent who needs care. The question is, how can someone in that situation afford to pay a caregiver the rate they deserve and also stay above water themselves? Because the threat of poverty looms large for both the caregiver and the receiver.
Absolutely. And this is where the moment is really critical, because if ever there was a generation that could transform how we treat and think about and support the aging process, it's going to be the baby boom generation. The combination between the power that boomers have to shape the future of public policy and the connection that millennials have to their grandparents. Millennials are more connected to their grandparents than any generation in history.
Why is that?
Because they have more time to connect with their grandparents. People are living longer, and they have more through social media and technology. There's just more ways to connect and more time to connect. And so I think that between the interest and passion that millennials and young people have for their grandparents and the power of the boomer generation to change culture, this is a moment to say, we need more support for caregiving needs for our families.
Well, let's talk about more support. You've got Medicaid, which is spending something like $49.8 billion a year providing nursing home care for our elderly. 90% of us want to die at home, and here this money is being spent there. Medicaid is not, and Medicare is not providing any money for those who want, or very, very little money for those who want to provide their loved ones with home care.
Right. We have no program in place to support home care comprehensively. If you're very, very poor, you can qualify for Medicaid. But even the Medicaid model is a very institution, nursing home-based model. If you are wealthier, you can afford to purchase long-term care insurance, but oftentimes that doesn't cover what you need when you need it. So the vast majority of Americans who are in between really have no social program in place. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about the care grid in the book. We actually need a whole new infrastructure and public policy system to support people's long-term care needs. And when we invest in that, we can actually create many more efficiencies in the healthcare system and actually save money in the long run.
Just because we know that this problem is coming and that this is what can help solve the problem, why are you optimistic that we can make this societal change?
Because we're a nation of solutionaries. We have created infrastructure to support our economic growth and development in the past. And when we think about the basic fundamental need that every working family has to have caregiving supports, I mean, this really does affect millions and millions of Americans. In order for us to actually see the kind of economic vibrancy that we need going into the future, I mean, we're talking about the sandwich generation, right, that's struggling with both child care and elder care, care on both sides of the generational spectrum, and going to work every day. I mean, it's an impossible situation without more support.
You know, when you talk about the sandwich generation, so many of us became parents later in life. And we also had, you know, an average of 1.86 children, and yet couples have four parents to care for.
That's right. There's an enormous amount of pressure on adults and young people in terms of who will care for us. And that's why this is the moment to create a whole new system of support. And actually, a lot of states are taking the lead, even if the federal government and Congress is not there yet.
New York, for example, was the first.
New York took the lead in establishing basic rights for caregivers. We now have four states that have established those rights. But we actually have new states coming up with new proposals to support aging in place and families to afford caregiving as well. The state of Hawaii this year in 2015 will be the first state to introduce a social insurance program for long-term care at the state level. So similar to Medicare or Social Security, people will pay into it. And when the time comes and they need long-term care, they'll be able to tap into those resources to support it. So that's one model. There are also caregiver tax credits, and we're looking at places where we could potentially expand the child care tax credit or the dependent care tax credit to more comprehensively support elder care. So there's lots of ways of starting to move towards this vision of better care that's more affordable for families and better jobs where caregivers can really support their families.
You say we have an opportunity now to tackle two of the major issues of our time. One of them is widespread unemployment.
That's right. That's right. There's the jobs crisis on the one hand, where we still need to create about 10 million new jobs to support all the people who are looking for work now. And then we've got this looming care crisis, where by 2050, 27 million of us are going to need some form of long-term care or assistance just to meet our basic daily needs. These two crises could potentially solve each other. We're going to need to create at least 2 million new jobs in home care. And if we can make these jobs good jobs that you can really take pride in and support your families on, I mean, it is a real win-win solution here.
Some people instinctively know how to be a good caregiver, and no one can really teach someone how to care. On the other hand, training is absolutely essential. Especially when we're dealing with a population, a large percentage of those 85 and older who are suffering from things like Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. So where does the training come in? And what level of sort of universal baseline do we need of care?
The vision that we have for the future of care has three core pillars to it. One being the improved quality of care through bringing this entire field out of the shadows. And a big part of that is training. And we have some great models for home care training around the country. One of them is in Seattle, Washington, where there's a wonderful statewide training institution that trains 40,000 home care workers per year in 12 different languages, including continuing education and distance online education. And it's really elevated the quality of care that consumers are receiving, as well as the quality of jobs. I mean, these are trained professionals who have an incredibly vast skill base that they're continuing to develop and support. And that is really what needs to happen, a level of professionalization and a way that caregivers can see that they are part of a care continuum and they're part of a career ladder that leads into jobs in social work and healthcare. And I think that when we start to value and see and invest in the care workforce in this way, it will not only elevate the quality of care, but also help the entire healthcare delivery system become more efficient, because the people on the front lines are going to be trained and really well integrated into the conversation with the doctors and the nurses and everybody else who's a part of the care team.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Ai-Jen Poo. She's featured on the upcoming PBS special Caring for Mom and Dad, which airs on Thursday, May 28th at 8 p.m., and she'll be here live following that special to take your phone calls. We hope you'll join us. What can we do for ourselves, and what can the government do for us?
We can actually have a conversation within our families now, and it's always best when it's not in a moment of crisis. And one of the things I'm doing on my book tour is encouraging families to have a conversation with two simple guiding questions. The first being, how do we as a family prepare for our future caregiving needs? And the second being, what do we imagine will be the joys of caring for one another? And we're hoping that that actually sets the stage for a different kind of conversation about both what will be challenging and what will be hopeful and what will be made possible by us actually having a plan and coming together in this way. And there's this really important role that I write about in my book, the care manager role. It's a role that has been developed recently where people who have some training in social work oftentimes are able to help families navigate what their care needs will be or are, and help develop plans as well if you need assistance. And then in terms of the government, this year, 2015, is the next White House Conference on Aging, which only happens once every 10 years. So we have this unique, timely moment and opportunity to elevate our caregiving needs on a national stage and really call for the kind of public policy change and support that we're going to need. And I think that that's everything from looking at innovations in social insurance to caregiver tax credits, to more training and more resources for training. I mean, there's lots that can be done today without a huge debate over the budget. Long term, we need to be calling upon our government to make a major investment in public dollars to support our caregiving needs.
How much support is there at the federal level? How closely are they looking at this, what you call this silver tsunami that's heading right for us?
I would say that there's also a bit of denial of what's to come, which is why all of us raising this to our elected officials is so important. We need to call upon our elected officials to also have a plan and to take action to support families. I would also say that there is a tremendous amount of support at the Department of Labor. There are places where people who are really in touch with the front lines of what families need get it. And it's a curious thing to me because I can't imagine that every single member of Congress doesn't have an aging loved one or themselves is aging and will need some more support. So I think that part of what's necessary is taking this conversation from one that's seen as more of a private individual issue to one that's a public conversation about our priorities as a country for the future.
I want to talk a little bit about your own story. Your mother emigrated from Taiwan. She earned a PhD and an MD, is working currently as an oncologist, raised you and your sister. Your
That's
parents
right.
divorced. Your grandmother, her mother, needs some care. So you write beautifully about the person in your family's life, Mrs. Sun. But one of the things you say in your book that really struck me was one of the biggest regrets in your life is that when your grandfather passed, mm-hmm. after, you know, these memories of him getting you off the bus when you were a child and then caring for his wife, your grandmother, after she suffered strokes, is that you weren't there for him at the last moments of his life.
That's right. I will always remember going to visit him at the nursing home. We had to put him in a nursing home against his wishes after he had spent so many years caring for us, and all he wanted was to be able to stay home. For the last 3 months of his life, he spent them in a nursing home. And in visiting him there, the image of that nursing home is forever sealed in my mind. He was living in a dark room. For some reason, they didn't turn the lights on ever. And there were about half a dozen other people in that room, and half of them seemed really like they had already departed, and the other half were just screaming and wailing in suffering. And my grandfather hadn't slept or eaten for what seemed like days. He said three. I think it was longer. And I just remember thinking that he was a shadow of the person that I knew, and that he was clearly dying inside. And so I will always be filled with some level of regret that we couldn't give him the option to spend his final days at home. And I want for every one of our loved ones to have the choice to be with and be supported by somebody like Mrs. Sun, like my grandmother has today. And I definitely think that it's partly because our family didn't have a plan, and partly because our government doesn't have a plan, that we didn't actually have that option for my grandfather. And that is what I want to change.
Is that what launched you into this advocacy that is connected to so many other movements in this country, from immigration rights to women's rights to racial justice? I mean, it's amazing to me how many movements are wrapped up in this one.
It's true. It's this place. Caregiving is this, almost like this, when you think about a gemstone and it refracts lights in different directions, it's like when you look into it, it's this place where so many different interests and experiences come together, where at the end of the day, caregiving is something that's so universal, universally needed as humanity. And there's so many different entry points from caregivers, families, seniors, people with disabilities, and then across lines of race and class. And everyone is part of the solution here, whether it's immigrants coming to this country and being able to join into this care workforce that we're going to need absolutely millions of more workers to support us, or whether it's more gerontologists or more family caregivers and support for family caregivers. It's kind of an all hands on deck and a role for everyone moment.
In 2012, you worked with the University of Illinois on the first ever national survey of domestic workers. One of the things you discovered was that a lot of our domestic workers come from 71 different nations.
Oh, it's a virtual United Nations in the care workforce. It's a very diverse workforce, lots of immigrants, but also lots of people from Pennsylvania and, you know, who've been in Pennsylvania for many, many years. And I think that it's a reflection of the families who need care, too. We're all people of all walks of life, do this work, want to do this work. Caregivers in particular are drawn to service. Many of the women who do this work take enormous pride in this notion that they are making life better for our elders.
Your book, The Age of Dignity, includes a lot of stories. You collect stories from caregivers. One of the things that struck me deeply is that some of our caregivers are here providing care for our families, and they're separated from their own families in other countries.
It's true. Many come from countries where there isn't the kind of economic opportunity that there is here. So I think of a woman named Mirla Baldonado, who came here in order to be able to send money home to her 5 children in the Philippines. And she cares for elderly people in Chicago and had over 20 patients and does everything from cooking soft Filipino foods for the people she supports to bathing and physical therapy and helping to take people to their doctor's appointments and just really helping to manage not only activities of daily living, but also quality of life for the people she supports. And she earns between $5 and $9 per hour for that work.
You tell a story of a woman who came to the United States, cared for a family of 6, did the cooking, cleaning, child care, and then slept in a bed in the basement where there was a sewage system that was overflowing. She was making $3 a day, and after doing this for 3 years, 18 hours every day, she was let go.
Fired with no notice, and she was a live-in caregiver, and so she was homeless overnight. And fortunately, she found friends in the neighborhood, churchmates who could support her and take her in for a few days. But really, she was here to work and to support her family. And all of her sacrifices kind of disappeared overnight when
that happened. And because she was here on a special visa, she was in some ways enslaved by her employer.
That's exactly right. And we've got not only people who are here on special visas, but many who are undocumented who are doing this work. And it's a vulnerable situation for them because they're always vulnerable to being detained or deported and exploited. And it's vulnerable for our families who count on these workers as well, because a friend of mine has an undocumented woman caring for his mother with Alzheimer's, and they are so close and connected, and he cannot imagine what would happen to his mother if one day the caregiver was detained or deported and separated from them. I mean, these are workers who've become part of us, and we're already all interconnected.
You know, there's vulnerability on both sides. There's vulnerability for the caregiver, and there's vulnerability among those who are being cared for.
That's right.
And that is really why we are all in this boat together.
That's exactly right. We are so connected here, and that's why, you know, even advocates who are really focused on the needs of seniors often connect the quality of care to the quality of the jobs for the workforce, because there's such a clear connection here. And the emotional bond is so, so profound. I was just reflecting to a group of students upon a story of a woman named Erlinda, whose story is also in the book, who sings to the people that she cares for because she believes that that's a universal language of connection.
And she refers to the woman she cares for as my lady, which is our caregiver for my mother, referred to her as m'lady. She'd come in and say, "What can I get you for breakfast, m'lady?"
Oh, wow.
And so when I read that, just blew me away.
Exactly. And she would sing to her lady every morning. And then one morning, her lady said, "Give me your hand," instead of asking for a song. And right away, Erlinda knew. I mean, this is how in tune the caregivers are. Right away, Erlinda knew that she was getting ready to transition. And she was able to call the family together, and they all experienced that moment with her lady, surrounded by a circle of love and connection and family, really just the way she would have wanted.
All right. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Ai-Jen Poo, author of The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. She'll join us for Conversations Live Thursday, May 28th at 9 p.m. on WPSU, immediately following the PBS special Caring for Mom and Dad. We hope you'll join us. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.